Tell me what you had for breakfast real quick.
Nothing.
No coffee?
I had a couple shots of espresso. I just got back from Europe last night around 8 p.m. I slept maybe 3 hours. I've been up since about 6 o'clock.
Well, this is going to be a good interview then. I'm looking forward to some fever dreams, you know?
No, you're going to be just Sullivan Fortin unfiltered, I guess.
Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, Director of Content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. My guest today is the multiple Grammy-winning Steinway artist, Sullivan Fortner. He is the recipient of the Gilmore's inaugural 2026 Larry J. Bell Jazz Artist Award. His latest release is the album Play with trumpetist Theo Croker on ACT Music. How did you go about finding your voice in jazz?
Finding my voice in jazz? I haven't really found it yet. I'm still trying to find my place in this music, honestly. I started playing piano when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And at the age of 7, it was just basically gospel music up until I was about 13. And then I went to New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, studied jazz there and took some classical lessons.
Why'd you study jazz? Let's start there. What drew you to that?
Well, there was this guy that came to my church. His name was Ronald Markham. And he started playing all these different styles and he started playing jazz. And I was like, man, those are the chords that I've been trying to play. I want to always play. What kind of music is that? He was like, you need to listen to jazz. And I was like, I don't know if I always say, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I hated it in the beginning.
Why'd you hate it? What was the barrier to entry for you?
It was too long.
The music was too long.
The music was too long. The music was too complicated. The idea of soloing was always, and still to this day, still very nerve-wracking. Mm. I'm very much a background person, kind of like to lie in the cut, be an accompanist. You know what I mean? That's how I was raised. That's kind of my comfort zone. And so when you have a spotlight kind of thrown in you, like jazz is a little bit, it's kind of narcissistic and ego-driven in a way, you know, in a sense where like you have a solo and people are actually listening to your solos. You know what I mean? But for me, that was very, very uncomfortable. And, you know, I hated it. And a lot of things that was happening rhythmically and harmonically that was difficult to hear and understand, at least where I was. You know, over time, those things became more exciting and a lot more interesting and fun. And now it's become an obsession.
Okay, you just mentioned how playing a solo is nerve-wracking. When you're playing a solo, what are you thinking about? Or are you even thinking anything?
I'm thinking of one of the first things that come to mind is the composition itself. Like, what is the tune that we're playing? And you know, kind of dating back to some of the more ancient practices of European Western classical music and Eastern music and African music, where you have a theme and themes are developed and kind of ornamented over time, exaggerated and kind of changed around through rhythms and through different harmonic devices. So those are the things I think about. Here's the basic structure. Here's the form of the tune. Here's the melody we're playing. How many different ways can I play this melody? That's the first thing. And then after that, everything I play after that is an extension of what I've played before. So I always tell people the difference between classical music and jazz, in my opinion, is when classical music stops, jazz begins.
And where does classical music stop?
At the end of the piece, at the end of the written piece.
at the double bar line, that's where it stopped. Yeah.
Right? For jazz musicians, that's the beginning.
You also must be a Thelonious Monk guy because he was all about the melody too.
Absolutely.
His improvisations sprang from the melody. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. And many of the masters, I would say people like Sonny Rollins and Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie to a certain extent, and Charlie Parker, all the great improvisers used elements of the melody in their solos.
Are those your guys, the four you just mentioned there?
Those are some of them.
Who else is in your jazz mix?
Errol Garner is number one for me. Errol Garner, Art Tatum, James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith and Fats Waller and Earl Hines, Mary Lou Williams.
So you go back to Errol Garner and you got some stride guys. Tell me, why is Errol at the top for you? What is it that you take from him?
He was the first person that I related to growing up in the gospel tradition, you know, in a sense where, like, you know, the stories of him not being able to read music, not being able to tell what key he was in, didn't even know the keys. He just could play. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there was something about listening to those recordings, the excitement and the fun and the play that he had. Everything was really light and really, really loose, even though it was still virtuosically and rhythmically insane. There was still something that was very, very relatable to the audience. And even those live recordings, you actually hear people responding in a way that they don't respond to a lot of other jazz musicians when they play.
And so far as what? As like their awe at what he's doing?
They're in awe of what he's doing, but they're also like, there's some people will yell and shout. Sometimes they will clap. You know what I mean? There's just kind of like that audience participation.
They're moved towards a reaction, much like your background in church.
Absolutely. Especially me. I was definitely moved. Like, I remember the first time I heard him. It was the first time I had ever experienced music in a way where it actually moved me to tears.
Tell me about when that happened.
I was in high school. It was about 14. And my teacher at NOCA told me, here's this album called Concert by the Sea. If you don't like this album, then maybe you should be playing jazz.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember listening to that. And I remember waking up out of a sleep and listening to it and like crying. You know, that's how much it woke me up. You know what I mean?
It was playing and it woke you up?
Yes. The music was playing because I fall asleep with music in my ears. You know, at the time I had one of those five disc changes CD players. So like, you know, out of like five CDs, that was like one of the five, maybe like CD two or three. So it was like, I don't know what time it was I heard it. But Teach Me Tonight came on and it woke me up immediately.
I'm going to have to go back to that one now because it's an enshrined classic, right?
It really is.
But still, that doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to it, you know?
Oh, that means you should listen to it more.
Right.
Especially now, like the more you start to play music, I start to question now where I am, like, what are the qualities that make an album like Kind of Blue so great? Mm-hmm. What are the qualities that makes an album like Concert by the Sea or We Get Requests by Oscar Peterson or Cooking with Miles, you know, Cooking, Steaming, all of those classics, those classic Sonny Clark albums. Like, what makes these albums classic?
And what's the answer to that? Think about all those albums you've just listed. What is it that they have in common?
Well, I mean, they're all so different. I would guess there's a certain type of intention that they come into when they play. Mm. There's a certain type of urgency. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a certain type of like directness. There's no fluff. There's no fat. You know what I mean? There's no, I got to warm up to this. No, there's a certain type of urgency. Whenever you hear Charlie Parker's Coco, it's just like, bam. It's like, it comes in and it's like, you don't have time to warm up. And the tracks are relatively short. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's kind of where I am so far.
Yeah, I like that. Immediacy,
yeah.
Intention,
right.
Directness.
Yeah. And then every time they play, every time you hear them, it's like Barry Harris used to tell us, you know, it's like whenever you hear stuff like that play, it almost feels like the sun comes out. Hmm. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. just like, Like, oh, life is beautiful. Despite all of the crap that we're dealing with. You know what I mean? Yeah. You can listen to that and you're just like, oh, thank you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Have there been other discoveries, epiphanies that you've had over the course of your jazz journey that has made you change your approach to music or your approach to the piano?
Well, one of the things is the idea of constant editing and constant pruning, a constant sharpening of ideas that don't necessarily always have to start from zero.
What do you mean by that?
I'm going to release an album in March, and the name of the album is Leave That In There. And basically the idea of Leave That In There is not being afraid of using old materials, things that you may have already played. You know what I mean? Tunes that you've already recorded, ideas that you've already written, and you're just reusing these things. You know what I mean? The idea of reusing them and trying to figure out different ways of using it. Kind of like the melodies and what I was talking about in the beginning of improvisation, mm-hmm. not really mm-hmm. starting from zero. Improvisation not being, okay, I'm just going to play whatever, wherever my hands fall. That puts a lot of pressure on yourself to have to start from zero. But if you come in with an idea, if you come in with a strategy, it's almost like when you're going to fight, you show up to battle with a plan. You always show up to battle with a plan. You never show up to battle just not knowing what you're doing or just being completely reactive.
Right. Like, okay, let's square up and see what happens.
Exactly. No, that's not what we do. And that's not what the masters have done. And a lot of times, if you listen to some of Monk's tunes, you find there's a connection of a lot of these songs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He'll take snippets of, he'll quote other songs in his composition, in his improvisation. He'll play a song like Nutty and probably quote something like Trinkle Tinkle. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And then also when he's playing solo, like when he's not with trio or quintet, it feels almost like he's writing the song as he's playing it, right?
Absolutely.
And I hear some of that in your music, which is to say there's a lot of space in your music. I never feel like you're in a rush. Mm-hmm. I hear a bit of what you're describing, the idea mm-hmm. of, okay, I have this diamond in my hand and I'm gonna keep turning it over. I'm gonna looking for new angles. I'm looking for new ways into this material.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Damn, where was I going with that? I was so shocked to be right, I didn't know where I was going with that.
That's good.
No, but yeah, so we're talking about Monk and let's take like Alone in San Francisco.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
When he gets to a bridge or he gets near the end, you just feel him go into full exploration mode, ending in the stratosphere before he does his trill in the top and right. his ninth in the mm-hmm. bottom or whatever. I feel like he knows the structure. He knows these rooms so well that he's going to go wandering around for a little bit and it's totally okay.
Absolutely. I think the cool thing about when you're somebody like Monk who, you know, who knows his tunes and knows those tunes so well, so much so that everything that he plays has kind of already been pre-planned and I mean, he's going to play the exact same voicings every time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's going to play. Some of the placement may be different, but the harmonies and the actual voicings and the note choices that he has, it's going to be the same. So there's always, even within that looseness, there's still a strict concept. There's still a structure that's solid. Like I remember talking to a lot of musicians who played with Monk or who hung out with Monk. One of the things that they always said was Monk was like a brick. Monk was like a rock. It's just like, boom, you know, it just came in. It was just solid, rock solid. Like you can depend on that shit. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, when he was playing with others, that's why I wanted to do a contrast between him solo and him with other musicians, because that time was locked in.
But even when he did solo, I'm looking at those videos and some of those concerts where he's playing songs like Dinah.
Yeah.
And he's playing, you know, even some of his original compositions, other than like songs that were rubato, like, you know, Crepuscule with Nelly, or, you know, things like that, mm-hmm. or like even the way sometimes he would play Monk's Mood, mm-hmm. or Panonica. But even Panonica was very, it would start out rubato, then he'd get into time and that sucker's like right in it, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's just like, I do understand what you're saying, it's the fluidity in him, his knowledge of structure.
That's it.
And his knowledge of form. It reminds me of Beethoven. The thing that made Beethoven so great was just his understanding of form. And structure, and how stuff was built and how it worked. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And its functionality. I think part of Monk's genius is that. Is that his structure and his stuff and, you know, what he you know, came up with was so strong and solid that it allowed him to have a whole bunch of fluidity and to roam around a little bit more. Whereas other people, you know, like younger musicians, they're trying to play like that, don't really have that. There's a certain type of understanding that they don't have about those basics.
New album that I think just dropped on Friday. I chain smoked it today before this call with you and Theo Croker on trumpet.
Uh-huh.
How do you change, or do you change your approach when you're playing with just trumpet instead of, say, a trio?
With the absence of the rhythm section, I actually have the option to be the rhythm section by myself or to not be. But, you know, and that's in any dual setting, whether it be with a singer or another horn player or whatever. But when I'm playing with the trio, I actually have drums and bass involved. So I don't have to play those roles. I don't play those roles.
So you have the option of taking on more responsibility from a rhythmic point of view, but you don't necessarily have to.
No. There's no rule that says you have to.
So when you went in to the studio with Theo, we talked earlier about having a plan. There's clearly a plan to this album. Tell me about that plan. What was the idea behind this?
That album took a couple of different routes, because at first the plan was to do all standards. And we recorded maybe like about 10 standards the first day of the session. And then maybe we did like a couple extra covers, and then we said, this ain't working. Let's go home. So we went home and came back the next day, and Theo was like, you know what? Let's just play free. Like, okay. I was like, well, let's play free, but let's set some like guidelines of how we do it. So, okay, so are we actually going to play free right? And so basically each composition other than the first one.
First one being A Prayer for Peace.
Yes. Prayer for Peace was pre-written already. It was already pre-composed by Theo. So everything else was basically like he had a list of instructions. So we'll pick this key, like one instruction be like, here's this note. We're going to start with this note, and we're going to grow from this note and then come back down to one note, right? Another rule was, okay, we're going to play fast. Mm-hmm. Another mm-hmm. rule was like, okay, this time we're going to play really slow. I said, this time I want you to just play chords. This time we're just going to do single lines. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just like we would make like these little rules for ourselves. And these situations kind of just happened in the moment with those guidelines. And strangely enough, you know, each song didn't last longer than maybe 3 minutes. What we liked about it was how honest it was, how in the moment it was, and how true it was to how we play, how we used to play when we were at Oberlin, and our relationship as brothers.
And maybe setting up these guideposts along the way, that did give it some structure, yet it also reads as a suite. I listened to it as a suite and it felt correct, you know?
Yeah, it connects. It connects. It definitely helps with the structure and a connection for sure.
And what I'm hearing is this didn't connect by accident. You guys got in there and said, okay, this one, we're going to do this kind of thing. And that's going to lead to this kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, always showing up to battle with a plan.
Free with structure.
That's right. Freedom, structure. You can't find freedom unless you have structure.
When you're sitting down and working on a tune, whether it's with Theo or whether it's with someone else, whether it's working on a standard or working on your own tune, what kind of goes into that? Are there strategies that you always use? Is it always different? Tell me about it.
It's different depending on the artist. If I'm working with Cecile McLaurin-Selvant, her ideas kind of come like over morning coffee. You know what I mean? Or like over a walk. And then she'll flush it out in a journal, and then she'll set some kind of imagery to it. You know, then she'll get to the music. And then once she gets to the music, then she calls me. And then we flush out some musical elements, and she'll teach it to me, and we'll expand it from there. Other people are like, well, I don't have lyrics. I don't have a storyline. I have some ideas. These are the songs that I want to play. Let's just play them, and you do your thing on it. As far as compositions and writing goes, I mean, for me personally, it varies. You know, sometimes it starts with a bass line. Sometimes it starts with a harmonic sequence. Sometimes a song, I'll set an egg timer and I'll set it for like 10 minutes and write a song. And that's it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, listen, people do that in the office. They're like, I'm going to set this timer and I'm going to work on this spreadsheet for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Right?
And if nothing comes out, it doesn't come out. The deal is not to force it.
Yeah, that focused energy, that's a cool thing. You're not just sitting there staring at the piano or staring at the blank page or whatever.
Exactly. That's what I meant by starting from zero. It's a really hard thing to do to start from zero. But if you come in with an ideal set of parameters, then it makes it a little bit easier.
I'm really enjoying these sirens in the background, man. This feels so urban, this conversation, you know?
Yeah, welcome to New York City.
Approaching a standard like Dahoud, that Clifford Brown, Max Roach song that you put on Southern Nights.
Uh-huh.
This is a song in the canon, right? Like we were talking about earlier, those bulletproof albums, bulletproof songs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something special that you have to do with those pieces where you say, okay, like what am I bringing to the table with this tune?
I never really think of that.
Okay.
Honestly, I feel like if it's a part of the canon, then the tune speaks for itself.
Right. Okay.
I don't really go from a place of like, what can I put on this song in order to make it hip? You know, the song is already hip and it was played by the best. The best that you can do in that situation is just honor what's there and honor the people that performed it while also being honest and true with who you are and where you are and what you understand.
If I talk to a great classical pianist, they'll say, yeah, I want to honor the composer's intentions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least in spirit, You know, it's not about playing exactly what they played, but it's about understanding why they played what they played and actually having a reason to play it. You know what I mean? And coming in with a certain type of humility and a certain type of grace when you play.
How do you put humility and grace into action? What might that look like?
It comes with study. It comes with the idea of understanding the traditions that the music comes out of, understanding the musicians and their stories, understanding the people that you're playing with too. Like that was a special rhythm section with Marcus Gilmore and Peter Washington. I mean, basically that recording was basically the set that we played every night at the Vanguard. And we recorded it in the middle of our week. I picked the song like that because, first of all, I knew it was something that everybody knew. So they wouldn't need to read it. You know what I mean? It's a song that we could just play and we could just have fun on. And it was kind of up-tempo, which is, you know, always nice in a set. You don't want to have a set of all ballads. Probably a lot of people can get away with it and it's great. I don't know how to do that. So
you'd been in the shed at the Vanguard with this set. These were familiar friends at this point in terms of repertoire.
Exactly. 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 We had started playing it on Tuesday night, and I think we recorded on Saturday afternoon. And we had also a Saturday night set and a Sunday evening set too. We were basically in the middle of living in all of those songs when we recorded it.
Sounds like a fruitful strategy.
Yeah, it's definitely a...
You're like, it's a move. It's a move.
It's definitely a move. It's definitely a move, you know.
What worked well with that and what were some of the challenges?
Well, I mean, it was not really necessary. I mean, I guess the challenge of it was, you know, actually pulling an all-dayer.
Ah, okay.
You know, yeah. Waking up at 10 a.m., getting to the studio at 11 to record 4 hours, and then go back to the Vanguard that evening and play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And thinking while you're playing the evening set, which you could have played in the recording, but you didn't, you know, you know, and then listening back to it and like wishing that I had done this differently or, you know, all of those things.
But that's the jazz thing about recordings that we have to acknowledge, right?
Yeah.
This is a snapshot in time.
Yeah, it's just a picture. That's all.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Errol Garner playing Teach Me Tonight from Concert by the Sea on Sony BMG, Thelonious Monk playing Panonica from Thelonious Alone in San Francisco on Concord Music Group, Sullivan Fortner and Theo Croker playing First Light from the album Play on Act Music, and Sullivan Fortner performing Dahoud with Peter Washington and Marcus Gilmore on Artwork Records. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush on a Steinway Model M, played by me, Ben Finan, Director of Content at Steinway & Sons. Our closing music is Open Palms from Fortner and Corker's aforementioned album, Play, on Act Music. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard, message me on Facebook at Steinway, or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Sullivan Fortner is a Steinway artist. Thank you for listening.